From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. This week, former President Gerald Ford was laid to rest. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the pivotal days between the resignation of President Nixon and the swearing-in of Ford as president, with Barry Wirth, author of 31 Days, The Crisis That Gave Us the Government We Have Today. Also, film director Richard Linklater. His film, A Scanner Darkly, is now out on DVD. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews What Exit, the major label debut by violinist Mark Feldman, and film critic David Edelstein reviews the films The Painted Veil and Miss Potter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The death of President Gerald R. Ford led us to consider the legacy of his administration, the challenges he faced at a unique time in history, and the power players in the Ford White House who became even more prominent during the current Bush administration. Our guest, Barry Wirth, wrote a book last year examining the first month of the Ford presidency. It's called 31 Days, and chronicles the transition following the post-Watergate resignation of Richard M. Nixon, the reasons behind Ford's presidential pardon of Nixon, and the early White House careers of Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Terry spoke with Barry Wirth last spring when the book was published. When Nixon resigned on August 9, 1974, Gerald Ford had to hold the government and the country together. He was the only president who was never elected to either the presidency or vice presidency.
There's so many things that make the Ford presidency unique, but one of them is that there were two-thirds Democratic majorities in Congress at that time, and Ford was not Nixon's first choice. In fact, he was probably his fourth or fifth choice, but the Democratic leadership in Congress made it very clear that only Gerry Ford would be acceptable. So Ford was chosen, and he had no aspiration to be president, so he was chosen more or less by mutual consensus between the White House and Congress, and he was chosen quite specifically because he didn't have any ambition to run for president himself. So when he came to office 10 months later, after Nixon's resignation, he was widely believed that he was not going to be running in 1976 in his own right, that he was going to be a caretaker. So here we have a man who was not elected to national office, had no aspiration to run for the presidency on his own, and had less than 48 hours to prepare for his presidency. Nixon, as we well remember, struggled to the bitter end to retain power and only left when confronted with certain impeachment in Congress. And when Ford was told that he would become president, he had 2 days to assemble a staff and to organize himself to become the world's most powerful political leader.
There was a transition team that was organized to help President Ford, and this transition team recommended that Ford not appoint a chief of staff at the outset, but that instead of a chief of staff, he should appoint someone who could rapidly and efficiently reorganize the staff, but who would not be perceived as chief of staff and would not be eager to become a chief of staff. And when Ford read this recommendation, he wrote in the margins, Rumsfeld. And that's the person who he chose. Why did he want Rumsfeld to be this transition manager?
Back in 1974, Rumsfeld was a former congressman from Illinois who had been instrumental in helping Ford rise through the congressional leadership. He was, fortunately for him, out of the White House during the most critical stages of Watergate. He was our NATO ambassador. But Ford knew that he needed to bring in somebody who would help him implement what he called a spokes-on-the-wheel organizational chart, as opposed to a top-down organizational chart, and who would not be afraid to move against the Nixon staff, somebody who was aggressive and unafraid to take on complicated problems, a maverick. He was comfortable with Rumsfeld from their service together in the House, and he thought that Rumsfeld was just the guy. But as you indicated in that that quote that you read, he wanted somebody to run the transition who did not want to be in that position and would not be perceived as wanting to be in that position. Ironically, just a couple of weeks after the pardon, Rumsfeld became Ford's so-called staff coordinator, but in fact he was chief of staff in the White House, and Dick Cheney was his deputy.
One of the big decisions Ford had to make was whether to keep Nixon's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger. Why was that a controversial decision?
The Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy, which was generally known by the term détente, which meant a lessening of tensions, was very controversial within the Republican Party. There were a lot of hardliners and hawks who felt that Nixon had gone soft on communism and that Kissinger's realism in foreign affairs was making the United States, as they put it, provocatively weak. it was probably the first truly controversial decision that Ford made. At the time, as someone put it, Henry Kissinger was America's foreign policy. Nixon had been so discredited by Watergate that Kissinger was America's face to the world. He was enormously popular, and he was enormously effective during the previous year in negotiating settlements between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Syria in the wake of the 1973 October War. So Ford felt very strongly that he needed Kissinger, but he knew that he was going to be inviting attack from the Republican right and from the so-called neocons who were just then beginning to address foreign policy issues.
And where did Rumsfeld stand on this?
At the time, Rumsfeld's charge was to stay away from foreign policy entirely. That was Kissinger's alone to run. When Rumsfeld and Cheney came into the White House to work on the transition, Ford was very explicit. He said, look at the Office of Management and Budget, look at the relationship between the White House and the cabinet departments, but stay away from foreign policy, stay away from defense, stay away from state. Subsequently, Rumsfeld challenged Kissinger, but at the time, Rumsfeld's duties were generally regarded as having to do totally with domestic politics.
What do you feel like you could learn about Rumsfeld and his deputy, Dick Cheney, by looking at their performance in the Ford administration?
Well, let me put it this way. Ford started out feeling very strongly that after Watergate and Vietnam, what the country needed to do was to move to the center. He adopted what one of the Washington Post writers called the mantle of the presidential center. The country had been so divided, so torn, and all power was reeling, and Ford was determined to unify the country. So he made a number of what in retrospect looked like extraordinary decisions. The first trip that he took outside of Washington, he went to the VFW convention in Chicago, really the most difficult audience he could find, to suggest that Vietnam War resistors should be welcomed home. There should be some sort of limited amnesty. He met with the Congressional Black Caucus, which Nixon had not met with for 5.5 years, only once, in fact, did Nixon meet with that Congressional Caucus. He chose as his vice president Nelson Rockefeller, who was widely despised on the Republican right. And in fact, the choice of Rockefeller catalyzed right-wing opposition to Ford and galvanized support for Ronald Reagan, who challenged Ford in the 1976 primaries. So what you had was a president starting out trying to move to the middle, trying to work with the Democrats. And then with the pardon, his popularity plummeted, went from 70% to 48%, and never really recovered. At which point, Rumsfeld and Cheney came in and tried to direct the Ford presidency, which was increasingly faced with a challenge from the right. And they moved Ford as much as they could to face that challenge and to implement right-wing policies himself. So in the same sense that Rumsfeld and Cheney became the center of strategic power in the George W. Bush White House, they became the center of strategic power in the Ford White House, and they did then, in somewhat lesser form, what they have done subsequently, which is to make sure that they never get outflanked by the right.
One of the things that President Ford had to do early on was to choose a vice president. What does the Constitution say about the position that he was in and how to choose a vice president?
The Constitution didn't have a provision about this in well into this century. And in fact, after John Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, there was no vice president at all until Lyndon Johnson was elected in his own right in 1964 and Hubert Humphrey came on. After that, Congress passed the 25th Amendment, which says that if there's an unoccupied vice president's seat, that the president shall choose someone who to be confirmed by Congress. So this was really the signal decision of Ford's first couple of weeks. He was having the opportunity to pick somebody who, as far as anyone knew, was most likely going to be the Republican candidate in 1976, since Ford himself had pledged not to run.
So how was Rockefeller finally chosen by Ford as vice president?
Well, it's Ford wanted somebody who had independent standing and stature. And Rockefeller was, in his own right, one of the world's most powerful people, coming from his family and also having been the nationally very popular former two-term governor from New York. And he also wanted somebody who would be a strong ticket mate in 1976. Rockefeller, it was believed, could help Ford win New York, probably California, maybe Florida. And he also was in agreement with the Nixon-Kissinger realpolitik in foreign affairs. So Rockefeller was really the strongest person that Ford could have selected.
You keep describing Ford as being someone who didn't plan on running for the presidency, and no one expected him to run for the presidency. His vice presidential appointee was considered to be the next presidential candidate, but that's not the way it worked out. Ford did run.
Yes, he did run, and in fact, he made the decision very early. Let me say first that Betty Ford had hated being in Washington and had, as we know, struggled with addictions and had had a very hard time as a political wife and really hoped that Ford would quit politics. In fact, Ford had planned after the 1972 election to leave Washington. His only real aspiration had been to be Speaker of the House, but he had not been able to win enough seats to make that happen. And so he first had to convince Betty that he ought to run himself. But really what was more crucial, which was pointed out to him by Henry Kissinger on the second day of his presidency, was that if he was perceived as a caretaker, that would invite a succession fight within the party that would begin immediately, and that foreign powers would take him less seriously. He realized that in order to be perceived as a strong president, even during this interim period, he needed to run in 1976 and show that he intended to be president for longer than that.
Barry Wirth speaking to Terry Gross last spring. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Barry Wirth, author of 31 Days, an account of the first month of the presidency of Gerald R. Ford.
One of the most important decisions that President Ford was faced with early on was whether or not to pardon Nixon. Why was that a decision that was filled with landmines along the way?
That's a very apt description. This could not have been an easy or straightforward decision under any circumstances. It was probably made more difficult by the fact that Ford owed his presidency to Nixon. But let me try to go through some of them. There were the legal issues first. Nixon had been named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Watergate cover-up. He was being investigated in connection with another dozen abuses of power, and the legal brief against him had grown enormous. And there was no question after the Watergate tapes came out that he was going to be indicted. The special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, did not want to indict him. He was looking for every opportunity to transfer the responsibility to somebody else. On top of all that, Nixon was quite ill. We'll never know exactly how ill, but he had suffered from phlebitis, which had caused him great pain, and it caused enormous swelling in his leg and had threatened to cause a stroke or a heart attack if he had a clot that got loosened into his bloodstream. Besides all that, he was obviously depressed. There were reports that he was drinking and suicidal. So Ford felt really enormous pressure right from the get-go from all sides to pardon Nixon, simply to put the Watergate morass behind the country in a way that only he could, by one swift and decisive act of presidential compassion and leniency.
Now, you think that there were personal issues in Ford's life that also led to him pardoning Nixon. What was the personal issue?
We tend to forget this now, but Gerald Ford was not born Gerald Ford. He was born Leslie King Jr. His father and mother divorced shortly after he was born. In fact, his father had started physically abusing his mother on their honeymoon. He was an alcoholic. In their divorce agreement, he was obligated to pay child support for Ford for during his growing up in Michigan, and he was a deadbeat. He never paid any of it to the point where when Ford was 25 years old and a law student at Yale, Gerald Ford's father, Leslie King, was put in jail briefly. Ford, in that, finally took the situation and became a broker between his parents. He brokered an agreement that his father would pay his mother a lump sum and the legal proceedings would go away. And this was a way of him closing out a chapter of real strain and difficulty that had dogged him throughout his life. And I believe Ford, on top of all these other pressures that he was feeling, had a kind of inner urgency to just resolve this as only he could by splitting the difference between the parties and sealing the record and getting Watergate behind the country and behind the White House so that he could go ahead and do what he needed to do, which is to lead the country out of Watergate and Vietnam. As I said earlier, Ford's popularity went from 70% to 48% and never really recovered. And it aborted what he was trying to do. After that, he was distrusted. The pardon ended up looking like the last cynical act of the Watergate cover-up. Here was President Nixon's handpicked successor telling the country that Nixon would not have to go to jail or even face trial, while 40 of his subordinates had faced legal proceedings.
Three of the people who were in the Ford administration, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz, eventually became to be considered hardliners. Were they considered hardliners in the Ford days?
Rumsfeld, I don't was the least ideological of the three of them. But yes, I think they definitely were considered hardliners. There were many people in the military and on the right who felt that that Nixon and Kissinger had compromised America's strength, and that America needed to be strong and to be able to assert its strength around the world. And I think that was the definition of hardliner. Certainly Cheney and Wolfowitz were among that group.
What was Wolfowitz's position in the Ford administration? He went on to become a Deputy Secretary of Defense in the George W. Bush administration and was considered to be one of the architects of the Iraq War.
Wolfowitz was nowhere to be found in the first 31 days. He showed up in the Ford administration as one of the key members of what was referred to as Team B. One of the things that Rumsfeld did the first time that he was at the Defense Department was he convinced Ford to set up a group that would independently review all of the intelligence that was coming into the CIA regarding the Soviet Union and its nuclear programs. They felt that the CIA was underestimating the Soviet threat. So Rumsfeld established this Team B. Wolfowitz was a key figure in that. This must have been 1974, 1975. And Team B issued a report which said that the Soviets were bent on world domination, that they were building space-based weapons to destroy us. Practically everything in that report turned out not to be true. But the Team B report became a rallying cry for hardliners who felt that that the United States had become weak and needed to become mightier and assert that might around the world. So this was really, in a way, a kind of a bookend to the so-called independence intelligence gathering that was done in the Defense Department in the run-up to the Iraq War, in which Wolfowitz was involved.
And did Cheney and Rumsfeld support Team B in their conclusions that later?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think this, you know, by the end, you know, Nixon had negotiated the first strategic arms reductions and was in the process of negotiating what was called SALT II, which was the second stage of that. By the end of the Ford presidency, Rumsfeld and Cheney had pretty much run SALT II into the ground. The word détente was no longer used in any of Ford's speeches, and the United States was starting to assert a more militant posture towards the world. This was part of their answer to Vietnam, which is, you know, we didn't lose Vietnam. We're stronger than ever.
Do you feel like you understand Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz any better from having studied their role in the Ford administration?
The Ford administration was truly the formative experience for them. I think they developed their attitudes towards the world and their position on America's role in the world as the sole superpower during that period. Of course, then we were still engaged in the Cold War with the Soviets, but this is where they prepared and trained for the power that they have had in the Bush administration. So in that sense, it's like going back to somebody's childhood to sort of figure out why they became the way that they did. I think we can understand a lot about Rumsfeld and Cheney by looking at how they became powerful the first time. And it should be remembered that at the time, Rumsfeld was 44 and Cheney was 33. When he became White House Chief of Staff, he was 35, the youngest Chief of Staff in history. So this was really his training.
Barry Wirth, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Barry Wirth, speaking to Terry Gross last year. His book on the first month of the administration of President Gerald R. Ford is called 31 Days, The Crisis That Gave Us the Government We Have Today. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Ovid's The Metamorphoses, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. And from Anne and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching. At breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, film director Richard Linklater on his film A Scanner Darkly, which is now out on DVD. Kevin Whitehead reviews What Exit, the major label debut by violinist Mark Feldman. And David Edelstein reviews the films The Painted Veil and Miss Potter. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Violinist Mark Feldman toured with country queen Loretta Lynn in the 1980s before moving to New York. Once he got there, he got involved with jazz and open improvisation and contemporary classical music, with, among many others, the Arcado and Masada string trios, trumpeter Dave Douglas, drummer Billy Hart, and composer Anthony Davis. His major label debut is out, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it deserves to be Feldman's big break.
Violinist Mark Feldman wasn't an obvious fit for the ECM label when he began recording for it as a sideman a while back. When I lived in New York 15 years ago, Feldman was easily the funniest presence on the downtown scene. Funny introducing tunes, funny telling stories about playing behind William Shatner and Jimmy Swaggart, funny saying hello. ECM records, meantime, tend to be a bit somber, some old Lester Bowie classics aside. But Mark Feldman isn't just funny. He's also an effortlessly lyrical player with exquisite control over his bow, an all-around terrific violinist who can play it straight. One thing Mark Feldman remembers, which some jazz violinists forget, is to take a breath once in a while. He doesn't just roll on because he can. Feldman wrote all the music on his new CD. Its title is a New Yorker's traditional comeback on hearing someone's from New Jersey. What exit? Romantic as much of the music is, Feldman gets to apply one asset that makes him hilarious. His timing. He builds and releases tension with a great comedian's grasp of beats and escalating momentum, from setup to punchline to topper to second topper. Two members of Mark Feldman's quartet are ECM regulars, English pianist John Taylor and Swedish bassist Anders Jorman. But the violinist's key ally comes from his own circle. He's played with drummer Tom Rainey since the late 80s in groups including the quintet New and Used with Dave Douglas. Rainey's phrasing can be a little loose and unpredictable. His occasional outbursts spill a little gravy on the clean tablecloth. In the end, What Exit works because of moments like that. Good Taste is cut with a whiff of anarchy, just enough to open things up. But seriously, Mark Feldman is such a tuneful and versatile violinist who's been making other leaders sound good for years. A classy showcase like this is long overdue. Thank you.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed the debut CD by violinist Mark Feldman, titled What Exit, on the ECM label. Coming up, film director Richard Linklater. This is Fresh Air. Richard Linklater's film, A Scanner Darkly, is a story about addiction, paranoia, betrayal, government surveillance, and corporate greed. The movie is animated with a computer process that kind of paints over the images of the real actors, a technique you can see in a number of current TV commercials. Linklater also made the movies Slacker, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, Before Sunrise, and Fast Food Nation. Terry spoke with him last year when A Scanner Darkly was in theaters. It's now out on DVD. The movie is based on the 1977 novel of the same name by science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. It's set 17 years from now in Southern California. Most of the characters in the film are addicted to pills called Substance D. The government is cracking down on the problem by going after users and encouraging citizens to report friends and neighbors who they suspect are using. Here's a scene from the film. Two characters, played by Rory Cochrane and Robert Downey Jr., are in a diner. Cochrane is a paranoid mess from Substance D and has had hallucinations that his hair and body are infested with bugs. He asks Downey to help him out.
I heard you have to go cold turkey.
Cold turkey doesn't even apply to Substance D. Unlike the legacy of inherited predisposition to addictive behavior or substances, this needs no genetic assistance. There's no weekend warriors on the D. You're either on it or you haven't tried it.
Well, I like it.
Yeah. How many caps do you take per day?
It's very difficult to determine, but not that many.
Well, like the old school pharmacopoeia, tolerance develops. You know, these visions of bugs, they're just garden variety psychosis, but a clear indication that you've hurtled over the initial fun and euphoric phase and passed on to the next phase. News from the guinea pig grapevine suggests that whatever it is, we won't know until it's way too late. You see, we're all canaries in the coal mine on this one.
Richard Linklater, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the drug of the movie, which is called Substance D?
You know, it's pretty vague in the book what Substance D is, and it was something that with the cast we talked about. Well, what would the properties of it be? What is it? Is it an opiate? Is it a, you know, stimulant? We never really defined it, and I think it's purposefully vague. But if you think about it, it's a designer drug, but it's really for kind of designed as a consumer product. But it's kind of the worst of all worlds. It's a consumer product, and it's really bad for you. It's highly addictive, and it ultimately, this is where the paranoia comes in, it's used for control. You lose yourself, and then ultimately you're kind of available as slave labor. It takes away the individual, but leaves the laborer. So it's your absolute most paranoid nightmare of your situation and how you're being used in a way beyond your darkest imagination. But I think that's valid thinking when you think of drugs in general. One of my heroes of all time was Frank Zappa, who was a big anti-drug guy. That resonated with me as a teenager. That's why I've never been a drug guy, because I took that to heart. You know, he's like, well, when you do drugs, there's a guy in an office wringing his hands saying, you know, profiteering off you, and you've removed yourself as a threat from the political spectrum. If you're just off using alone in your own world, you're not really challenging the status quo or the powers that be in any way. You know, it's a statement perhaps, but from a dropout perspective. Yeah.
You're using the same animation system in A Scanner Darkly that you used in Waking Life, and it's an animation that's built on real live actors. I'm going to ask you to describe what this type of animation is.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really a succinct name for it. It's a computer variation of rotoscoping, kind of an old technique where the animators draw over existing imagery. In our case, we make the movie like any movie. You cast, rehearse, shoot, edit, all that live action like a regular movie, lock picture, and then you start the lengthy animation process, which is, in my case here, about 50-plus animators sitting down on home computers and spending over about 500 hours to produce 1 minute of the animation. Very painstaking, but a very artistic process. I mean, these are really talented drawers and painters and artists, so it's like doing the movie twice, really.
Is there anything you did different directing the actors for A Scanner Darkly, knowing that it was ultimately going to be an animation?
You know, I think every actor on the movie would probably have a different response to that. I mean, Keanu and Winona would say no. You know, they're very realistic, if anything, even more realistic. But that's their characters. I think Rory Cochrane, Woody Harrelson, Robert Downey Jr. might say it freed them up, or I pushed them a little more. Their performances are a little bigger. I think that's their characters, and that's the story. I think live action, it might have seemed a little too big, maybe, but the animation, I think, kind of forgives it in a way, and you just accept them as a character. You know, they're having these, you know, thought bubbles and seeing things and hallucinations, and I think they felt free to kind of push it a little bit.
Your movie adaptation of A Scanner Darkly ends with a quote from the Philip K. Dick book. And I want to read that quote. It says, "This has been a story about some people who were punished entirely too much for what they did. I loved them all. Here is a list to whom I dedicate my love." And after each name on the list is an explanation of what happened to the person: deceased, permanent psychosis, permanent brain damage, permanent vascular damage, permanent pancreatic damage. He writes, "In memoriam, these were comrades who I had. There are no better. They remain in my mind. The enemy will never be forgiven. The enemy was their mistake in playing. Let them play again in some other way, and let them be happy." Do you feel like you have a similar list of friends who you lost to drugs?
I think everyone working on the movie, and I think everyone in life past a certain age, you do have a list of friends who, if not drugs, it's alcohol, it's other self-destructive maybe elements they brought into their life. And, yeah, you lose people along the way. So I think everyone working on the film, we were all working off our own lists. And we didn't even talk about it that much. It was just sort of there. But, you know, we're paying, you know, respects to Philip K. Dick's list because that's, you know, it's his story. But I think in a personal way, the way we're all aboard this project, we all felt, you know, we had those people. And it's a sad fact that some of the brightest, most intelligent, gifted people do kind of burn out and self-destruct young, you know, much earlier than their time. You know, it's you know, one of the tragedies of life. And Philip K. Dick himself died much too young. He was only 53. Which, when I was 22, you know, when I heard he died, I was like, well, that's, you know, he lived, that's a long time. You know, as you get closer to that, you start thinking, wow, that was really young. There's 20, 30, yeah. 30 more years of books he could have written. The tragedy, and then you meet his daughters, and you realize, oh, they have kids now that never got to meet their grandfather. The human toll there is enormous.
Was his death related to drugs?
Well, brought on. He died of a, you know, stroke, heart attack, you know, these kind of things brought on by, you know, a long period of amphetamine use. So, yes, I mean, when I first met his daughters to get the rights to do this novel, they were very protective of it because it was so personal to their dad, and they were very concerned about the tone I was going to take, in particular in relation to the drug use. I mean, Issa, his youngest daughter, told me, you know, just so you know, she pointed to the list, you know, that's my dad, because Philip K. Dick put himself on the list. And then she pointed down the list a little more and said, you know, that's my mom. You know, I lived in that house. We moved out, and then those guys moved in. So, and if it wasn't for drugs, you know, our father would still be writing. So they just wanted to know what my take was on the drug element.
How did you first get to watch movies that weren't the movies playing in the multiplexes?
Well, for me, it was curiosity. I'd been to a couple years of college, and, you know, every college professor is kind of a, every English professor is a, you know, film critic. So we started, this is in the early days of, you know, VCRs. We'd watch a film at night, you know, once a week in the English department that I was studying. And, you know, it'd be Clockwork Orange or 2001 or, you know, something. And we'd talk about it, and it got me thinking about films in that way. At that point, I think I was an aspiring writer, maybe playwright. I was writing some plays, but I hadn't really thought seriously about cinema. You know, I grew up in East Texas, and it wasn't a career option, especially back then. I don't think people even knew what a director did. You know, for me, films are just something that came to our town. We watched them, and they went away, you know. But once I started thinking about it seriously, I just started seeking out alternatives in the history of cinema, and I found myself, I was an offshore oil worker for a few years. I was living in Houston, but they still had repertory theaters, and when I wasn't on the rigs, I was in a movie. I just found myself in a movie theater watching three, sometimes four movies a day. I'd go home and read about the talent involved in the movie, you know, the writers, the director, the producer, whoever, you know, actors. I was just educating myself. I bought some books on the technical aspects of filmmaking, and I just found myself being totally taken over by cinema. I realized I had films in my head. So I was just doing a segue from my earlier ambitions into realizing cinema was probably the medium. It was kind of discovering, I was discovering it. So it was a wonderful, wonderful period in my life. I just saw tons of movies and educated myself and thought about getting in film school, but I never did.
Do you have any idea when you first realized that there was such a thing as a film director? That it wasn't just like stories and actors on a screen, that there was actually a job called director, and it might be a job you'd be interested in doing?
Gosh, I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to say I didn't really know. I was probably almost college age, I mean, which is unfathomable now, but, you know, 25 years ago, it was, I mean, it wasn't a part of the culture. I knew who Alfred Hitchcock was just because he was that kind of big guy who he had something to do with those scary movies. I thought maybe he wrote them, or I didn't know. You know, growing up, he was like the famous guy. But I think Martin Scorsese was one of the first ones I really like went out of my way. Like, oh, I saw Raging Bull, and I was like, wow, geez, you know, film can do that. And then I like looked it up. Oh, there's this movie Taxi Driver I need to see. So I, you know, was playing at this repertory theater. I went and saw that, and I started kind of like, oh, wow. You know, what an artist. You know, I discovered him, but at the same time I was discovering, you know, world cinema and the French New Wave and the new German cinema. And, you know, it was just all hit me at once. But I came to it really late, but I certainly caught up pretty quick. But I'm kind of glad it wasn't an ambition of mine growing up. I think if you're 9 years old now, I meet nine-year-olds who want to be film directors. I'm like, hey, you know, that's great. It's probably not a lot different than wanting to be a pro ball player, though. You know, so the odds of you actually getting to do this at this level are probably even less. But not a bad ambition to have, but kind of a hard skill set to define that I'm still trying to figure out. But I feel myself very lucky to whatever combination it is to be able to, you know, be here and get to keep doing it. You know, I feel lucky.
Well, Richard Linklater, thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, really nice talking to you. Thanks, Terry.
Filmmaker Richard Linklater speaking with Terry Gross last year. His movie A Scanner Darkly is now out on DVD. Coming up, two new movies reviewed by David Edelstein. This is Fresh Air. In December, studios tend to open movies for grown-ups in New York and L.A. so they'll qualify for the Academy Awards. Then they release them nationally in January. And so it is with two films, The Painted Veil and Miss Potter, one from a novel by W. Somerset Maugham, the other about the life of the author and illustrator of Peter Rabbit, among many other animal stories. Film critic David Edelstein reviews both films.
In movies, there will always be an England. That is, a Victorian or Edwardian England, of bustles and derby hats and sexual tension barely masked by formal manners. There'll always be an England, even if producers have to cast non-English stars to get their pictures financed. Now come two period films, The Painted Veil and Miss Potter, featuring three international actors, the Americans Renee Zellweger and Edward Norton, and the Australian Naomi Watts. They both make for decent escapist fare, but they'd be better, I think, if their Englishness wasn't in quotation marks. The Painted Veil is based on W. Somerset Maugham's 1925 novel, from an era in which white people fantasized about journeying to third world countries, tending to the sick, and discovering in the midst of death a higher calling. The film centers on a desperately bored flapper, played by Watts, whose plotting bacteriologist husband, played by Norton, discovers she's sleeping with a rake, played by Liev Schreiber. So he blackmails her into accompanying him to a rural Chinese village in the middle of a cholera epidemic. He makes her sleep in the bed of a missionary who expired a few weeks earlier. It's the sort of leisurely English movie where she takes a while to confront him about it.
I know you're angry at me, but if we could just try and talk about...
Honestly, I don't understand you. What is it that you want from me?
Perhaps I just want us to be a little less unhappy.
You're mistaken in thinking that I'm unhappy. I have far too much to do here to think of you very much at all.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say. I feel useless.
What do you propose that I do about
that? For God's sakes, Walter, will you stop punishing me? Do you absolutely despise me?
No, I despise myself.
Why?
For allowing myself to love you once.
Norton is unconvincing, to say the least, but these scenes are powerful anyway. The director, John Curran, made the marital psychodrama We Don't Live Here Anymore, which also featured Watts. And here he gets at something that Maugham glides over, the sadistic passive aggression of this repressed cuckold. He's so horrible that when his wife begins to register his selfless devotion to Chinese villagers and to find him attractive, it's quite bizarre. It's also way, way out of keeping with the movie's source. Maugham's heroine has a spiritual and religious awakening, not a romantic and sexual one. That said, The Painted Veil makes for a good old-fashioned widescreen diversion. And Naomi Watts is so open, so soulfully petulant, so transcendentally pretty, that even Maugham might reconsider the pleasures of the flesh. In Miss Potter, Renee Zellweger has rounded gerbil cheeks and squinched-up little eyes. She looks less like Beatrix Potter than a Beatrix Potter illustration. As she proved in Bridget Jones's Diary, she's in clover playing English girls. She snuggles herself inside her accent and blithely pops out her lines. She's dear enough to make this 19th-century biopic bearable, but you have to love the genre to sit through scene after scene of dialogue like, "Really, Beatrix? What young man is ever going to marry a girl with a face full of mud?" And on in scenes that make their biopic points and then skip biopicishly along. Beatrix is unmarried and, according to her snobbish mother, likely to remain so as long as she's always painting garden creatures with waistcoats and walking sticks instead of sensibly allowing herself to be courted. But her beasties are her friends, she insists, and by way of illustration, the director, Chris Noonan, who made Babe, brings them to cartoon life, often with a sprinkling of piano keys, like fairy dust. It's less cloying than it sounds, but the movie could use a touch of something less Beatrix Potterish. The focus shifts to the so-so tentative courtship of her insipidly sincere publisher, insipidly played by Ewan McGregor. Dark clouds loom. In a biopic, there's no such thing as an insignificant cough, and a character who goes out in the rain without a coat is signing his own death warrant. Miss Potter hardly deserves ridicule. It's rather sweet, with lovely Lake District vistas and a heartfelt endorsement of land conservation. And I'm happy that Zellweger got to traipse around the hills and dales, hugging a sketchbook to her chest and talking to cartoon ducks. It's a nice change from Cold Mountain, where she was wringing the necks of roosters. We all should have a chance to play English for a time.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting the efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. And from Patricia Papper for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Alex Kapranos, frontman for the indie rock quartet from Glasgow, Franz Ferdinand. Kapranos has a new book about eating on tour. It's called Sound Bites. Join us for the next Fresh Air.